on there. And guess what? I forgot to ask Suzanne to do a map. But you all got your school atlases out in your minds, have you? So, you know, but anyway, you go to the next thing, you know, next level. So that's Palestine, Israel, whatever, in Jesus' day. And so you're talking about Galilee and you're talking about Jerusalem down here. So any idea where Antioch is? Sort of up the coast here. I mean, it's like it's off the map a bit, but it's in more or less in modern-day Lebanon, okay? Do you know where Tarsus is? That's even further off the map. That's around, this is the Mediterranean, right? The side of the Mediterranean, eastern side, school map in your head. You go around the coast, what country have you got when you go around the coast here? Turkey, isn't it? On the top there, big, well, it is now anyway, called Asia Minor in those days, okay? So on that south coast, so not as far along as Gallipoli, you know, which is further along that coast, but more towards this end, there's a city called Tarsus, which is the other one we had mentioned. So that was all. So you didn't need the fancy video either, did you, after all? Jewish community. So this is, of course, what I've just shown you is a map of where we associate. You know, the Jews is living in what we now call Israel or Palestine. But, of course, it was part of the Roman Empire in Jesus' day and in the time of the readings we're hearing. But there were Jewish communities, not just in Jerusalem, where, of course, they'd rebuilt the temple, or King Herod had rebuilt the temple, but all over the place. Alexandria had a huge Jewish community in what's now modern-day Egypt. Damascus, all these places around had Jewish communities. And because they'd been a bit scattered with the whole Babylonian exile and the time after that, and the whole Jewish faith had actually changed quite a bit, because by the time of Jesus, you had quite a mix of hardcore, you know, got to be in Jerusalem at the temple, speak Hebrew, read the Bible in Hebrew sort of Jews. And then you had these ones who were scattered further around, who of course lived in the main language of the empire being Greek. That was the sort of the language of, you know, and that's Alexander the Great's fault. So, you know, the Jews had even translated their scriptures into Greek. And a lot of the teachers actually in the New Testament actually quote the Hebrew scriptures, the Old Testament, in Greek rather than Hebrew, because that's what they're familiar with and their listeners are. So these Jewish communities are scattered around. And one of these is in Tarsus, where Saul is from. Anyway, as I mentioned, the temple, the huge temple that Solomon built in Jerusalem, which was then destroyed 580 BC, then has been rebuilt by Herod. So the temple, the Jerusalem, has now become once again a real focus for the Jews and their faith. And when Jesus of Nazareth appears on the scene, they are walking this political tightrope, you know, with respect to Roman rule, where they have to be obedient to Roman rule, but they want to exercise their Jewish customs and practice their faith in God, in Jehovah and Yahweh, and in, you know, with the hope of a coming Messiah. So that's why they feel threatened by disturbances and new sects and things and radical movements, and so Jesus of Nazareth ends up being crucified in that whole turmoil of the Roman Empire. Meanwhile, in Tarsus, around there in what's now Turkey, the south coast of Turkey, there is one of these Jewish communities. And Tarsus may not mean much to us, the name now, but it was a centre of education and of commerce. Saul himself describes it later on as, "I'm a citizen of no mean city." It was quite a significant city of the Roman Empire and of that part of the world. It was the main city of the province of Cilicia, which is mentioned also in the New Testament. It's also the place where Mark Antony and Cleopatra met. How about that for a strange fun fact? Tarsus. So, you know, it was on the map. The fact that that's recorded means that Tarsus was on the map. And it's sort of, when you say that, you think, ah, yes. You know, the story of the New Testament doesn't take place in some religious vacuum. It's like real history in real time with names we know. So in this community, there's a young man brought up called Saul, or in Hebrew, Shaul. It's interesting that at this time, Jesus, or in Hebrew, Yeshua, or Joshua, Joshua, that there's a huge revival of the patriarchal names of the Old Testament. if you look through the Bible, I don't think you find a Saul between King Saul and Saul of Tarsus. In other words, it's a name that's fallen into disuse until this time when all these names are revived. So in Jesus' disciples, you see a couple of Jacobs. We call them James, but their name is Jacob. And Levi and Simeon, we call them Simon. But, you know, all these patriarchal names get revived. And Saul is one of these, Shaul. So he's later on describes himself, I'm a Hebrew of the Hebrews from the tribe of Benjamin. And if you think about it, King Saul was from the tribe of Benjamin. So what more staunch name could you give a young boy from the tribe of Benjamin than Saul? That's about as strong a tribe of Benjamin name as you could possibly give this young man. So, as I mentioned, Tarsus was a place of great education, just like Manchester is. Random reference. But if you are living in Tarsus, and you know that there's wonderful schools there, like there are in Manchester, you may feel the need to go to Oxford. Because that's even better, isn't it? Oxford University must be better. Do you see what I mean? Do you know that name in New Zealand conjures up like the university? You know, Oxford, mention Cambridge as well if you really want to, but, you know, Oxford University, wow, you know, like that's the centre. So from Tarsus, are we going well here? Good, okay, good. So he goes from Tarsus to Jerusalem to learn, to study. He's obviously an up-and-coming young, you know, potential rabbi sort of guy. And he's sent there, and if you think about it, he's going to Jerusalem. That's where the temple is, and that's where they're actually real Jews. You know, none of this Greek nonsense. He's going to learn Hebrew, and he's going to learn, you know. But he's going to bring all that education with him, this young man. Basically, Saul joins the conservative establishment in Jerusalem. Now, you think about these movements, these political movements, and I'm thinking of something like, say in America, something like the Ku Klux Klan. You know, they depend on young men then buying into this. It's not just an old thing. They depend on young men reinvigorating the movement. And so this is what Saul is. He's come to where the conservative fundamentalist establishment is in Jerusalem, where they are dealing with a new bunch of dangerous people who are preaching that there is a Messiah from Nazareth, Jesus, Yeshua, and proclaiming that he's resurrected from the dead, and there's this new sect within their Jewish faith. And it's becoming, we've heard the stories the last few weeks, it's becoming out of hand. People are going, you know, making this like the center of their faith and seeing in Jesus the fulfillment of all those prophecies of the Messiah and the coming King. And it's based in Jerusalem. Right? The apostles are in Jerusalem. So there's Saul. He's a young man, a rabbi in training. He's single, probably from a well-off background to be sent there. Can you imagine that? He might be fairly well-off. Arrogant. Sort of goes with the territory a bit, doesn't it? Keen to impress. Very religious. Full of commitment. And he sees this commitment as being worked out in joining and supporting the establishment in suppressing this new movement. And as we heard last Sunday, he's just heard this sermon from Stephen, the speech from Stephen that basically says, you've always been like this, rejecting God, and now you're rejecting Jesus. And he's there approving of Stephen's execution. We heard some of that story this morning, but you find other bits of it in the book of Acts. When Saul gives the account, the testimony, if you like, of his life, he is never leaves out the fact that he was part of that persecution. In Acts chapter 22, he says, I'm a Jew born in Tarsus of Cilicia, but brought up in this city. That means he moved to Jerusalem actually when he was quite young. I studied under Gamaliel. Do you remember him in the trial? Gamaliel was the chap who wisely said, look, if this is of God, you can't stop it, so just hold back. Gamaliel, who was like the top scholar and thoroughly trained in the law of our ancestors, I was just as zealous for God as any of you are today. I persecuted the followers of this way, which is what the Christians were known as, to their death. That makes you stop a bit. To their death. Not just Stephen. This guy has got some serious baggage, if you like, some serious backstory here. Arresting both men and women and throwing them into prison, as the high priest and all the council that can themselves testify. That's Acts chapter 22. In chapter 26, we have the same thing. On the authority of the chief priests, I put many of the Lord's people in prison, and when they were put to death, I cast my vote against them. This is the man we're dealing with. So, the followers of Jesus, when Stephen's put to death and Saul's part of this persecution, you know, putting them in prison, the believers are scattered out through Judea and Samaria, so out from Jerusalem over the rest of that map. Now there's an irony here. Didn't Jesus tell the apostles, you'll be my witnesses in Jerusalem and Judea and Samaria and to the ends of the earth? We've been back in chapter 1, haven't we? So this is a few years after that, and they're actually still in Jerusalem. Have you thought about that? They don't exactly get out of Jerusalem very fast. Sort of reminds you of the church in any age, really. We sort of stay in the building a bit rather than go out too much, or we sort of, you know, here we are camped here. But they're sent out. But here's the irony. It's not the apostles that are sent out. Did you notice that in the reading? The apostles stay where? In Jerusalem. Now, I don't know why it says that they all were scattered except the apostles. Maybe they kept the apostles in Jerusalem to sort of keep the lid on it. I don't know. Maybe they stayed because the apostles were expecting the coming of the kingdom, and so they would need to be in Jerusalem and expecting Jesus to come back to Jerusalem. I don't know. But it's interesting. They stayed in Jerusalem. The others spread. It's nothing like sending out untrained evangelists and people witnessing to Jesus in their lives without a lot of training to get in the way. Because what happens? They go out and spread the word and people believe, receive it. I mean, it's not even a properly organized mission. If you think about it, you know, we would organize a mission now, wouldn't we? Let's send some people out and preach out there. This is the result of persecution. They are sent out by the authorities driving these believers out of Jerusalem and scattering them. Thinking, of course, that that will squash the movement. And it has the opposite effect. And it's always had this effect with Christianity. It's wonderful. The only thing that keeps a lid on Christianity is when there's a time of non-persecution, which is sort of much where we are now, right in this room. Interestingly enough, we know this from China, that when they evicted all the missionaries from China in the 1940s, everyone thought, well, that'll be the end of the church in China. Because they'll only be these immature young Chinese Christians. They won't know how to run a church. So what's the result of that? There are 100 million Christians in China now. How did that happen? Well, it's God, of course. So they go out to Jerusalem, Judea and Samaria. The apostles, meantime, are still in Jerusalem. This strange irony is, because remember, the apostles are actually from Galilee. They're not from, Jesus called the apostles from Galilee. It's strange how, you know, even though we were, yeah, anyway, that's just strange. Anyway, so the message goes out and it's going up the coast to Lebanon, Syria, and Antioch. Now, this gets messy now because people believe who are not Jews. And the whole point of this faith is it's the Jewish Messiah. So now it gets complicated, right? For the first time. Really complicated. And the church back in Jerusalem is a little bit worried, aren't they? You notice how they've got a... We're like this in the church, aren't we? Oh, there's a new group meeting out so-and-so. We better go and check them out and make sure they're, you know, doing things properly. Did you notice that in the reading? So they... As if we ourselves would be doing it better than them, whatever. But those, so they, who do they send? Do you remember from the reading who they send out to Antioch to sort of check them out, make sure they're Barnabas, right? Barnabas is an amazing guy. Remember, he's the guy that sold, he's a priest, whatever, he's sold a field, and he's sort of like a in-between go-to guy, and he goes up there and teaches them. Now, they have a big problem. They've got this new community. This is like a big first. Now, you're sitting there, think about this. Nowadays, we sort of think of the church as a non-Jewish place, although some of us may have Jewish ancestry here, whatever. But we think of it as a, you know, almost as a Gentile thing. But, of course, it was a Jewish thing. And this is the first community where there's a mixture of Jews and Gentiles. Now, think about the conflict of obeying the law of Moses. Do you see what I mean? There's like two completely different mindsets here. And, you know, of all different shades. And Barnabas is encouraging them. Now, Barnabas has a great idea. He fetches Saul from Tarsus. Now, think about this. Now, we know what happens in between. I've sort of jumped, haven't I? I've missed out the conversion of Saul, right? You know, Saul meets Jesus on the road to Damascus. And the result of that is that he's then, you know, goes, you know, he is healed then and he has some time in Arabia. And he comes back to Jerusalem. We're going to hear that in a couple of weeks' time. But basically, he comes back to Jerusalem, meets the apostles, and wherever this guy goes, Saul goes, there's trouble because of his background. Yeah, this is like, I mean, the hellish solution is, I don't know if you've, you know, think about the evolution versus creation debate. How much international news would it be if Richard Dawkins suddenly became the most ardent creationist and became the guy that, you know, over the world media said, guys, I've sorted it now. Do you see what, it's that much of a change. Saul was the guy who was putting the Christians to death. Meets Jesus, has a complete change, but here's another interesting thing. He ends up going back to Tarsus because he's too hot to handle in Jerusalem. He's, you know, it's like people want to lynch him. So he goes back to his hometown, and he's there for years. Now think about this. Saul was called on that road to Damascus. And what happens with his call? Nothing, pretty much. He goes back home. Ends up, it's all, you know, stymied. But Barnabas goes, I know the guy for this situation. Why? Because Saul has complete Jewish background, thorough Jewish training. But what else does he have? He has complete Greek training from his education back in Tarsus, which is a sort of Greek-type city as well. He's got secular education, if you like, as well as, and he's this intelligent man. And here's the thing most of all, he's a man who's experienced the grace of God. Now, think of the twist of this. This is like, you know, you've listened to my story a bit and thought, that's amazing, Paul, how did that happen, that happened? But it's not just me. You have stories like that too, and you think, wow, and God used that, and then it went this way, and then, whoa, how did God do that? Because then this person, that happened there. Do you know what I mean? These sort of stories. But think about Saul. The church ended up in Antioch because of the persecution that Saul was part of, right? So Christians, so believers get scattered to Antioch, where they have the new Christian community. That's where it says they're called Christians for the first time, right? They're there, but they've got a mess because they've got Jews and Gentiles. So who ends up being the guy that comes to teach them? Saul. I mean, only God can think of something as crazy as that. The guy who put to death their friends. Are you getting this? This is off the scale how, you know, imagine how they learned about grace then. This is him. This is the guy. And that's why I've telescoped those two readings. Because when I noticed that, I thought, what? I never even noticed that before. That's him. It's sort of like inadvertently creating future employment for himself, you know? In some strange way. But God uses it. This twist and turn thing. AGM next year, sorry. But I mean, we're experiencing it in our musical, aren't we? Who's the person in the musical? Have you seen Les Miserables? Who's seen the show? About half of you. But anyway, for those of you who haven't, really, the two main characters, it's actually a It's interesting. They both have a real crisis in their lives. And at the moment of crisis, there's a choice. And the simple choice is this, that Javert looks into the void and sees the only choice for him is to kill himself. He can't cope with, he feels like the walls are closing in. And although he's been shown grace, amazing grace, think about those of you who know the story, amazing mercy, what's his response to that? No. Refuses it. I will not have the situation of my life owing my life to someone else. That's his response. Valjean has exactly the same experience. He also stares into the void at the start of the show. Same music, same song. And he makes this, and he's actually a bad guy, criminal. And he decides to let the grace of God act in his life. And this is what Paul does. And this is the choice for all of us. Not just Paul, for all of us. Choice this morning and every day of our lives. Will we, whatever our past, whatever our the twists and turns of our life, whichever long way we've come around it, will we allow the grace of God to act in our lives? And will we allow the grace of God to act in the lives of the people around us? But I better stop, otherwise the AGM will be at 1 o'clock. Let's pray. Heavenly Father, thank you for your grace and your mercy. Thank you for the amazing story of this young man that we know as Paul, and it's hard not to call him Paul because we know the story afterwards. But Father, if you can do things with this man, you can do things with anybody. So we bring ourselves to you this morning, the people we love and pray for. Join together in prayer now for those that we know, whom we're in contact with, for whom we are the light of Christ in their lives. We ask that your light shine clearly through us, that we be your people, that we always choose the grace of God above that despair and hopelessness. Choose to put our trust in you. Your kingdom come. Amen.